Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 3, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, our topic is titled Civil Rights Commissions, Enforcers of Social Justice, and is hosted by our Civil Rights Practice Group. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Karen Lugo, who is the founder of the Libertas West Project. After our speakers give their remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Karen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Micah. As we know, the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court proceedings spotlighted the unmitigated hostility that members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission held for Jack Phillips' Christian beliefs in declining to provide a cake in commemoration of a gay wedding. This, quote, disparagement of Phillips' faith is despicable, end quote, provided common ground from which a 7-justice Supreme Court majority overruled the findings of the Colorado Civil Rights Division, the ALJ judge, the Civil Rights Commission, and the Colorado Court of Appeals. But now that the commissioners from high levels to low have been corrected for revealing overt bias and animus in administering unequal treatment, is there a danger that the bias will just be concealed, and will the treatment of those who do not comply with the commission's favored viewpoint continue to slight constitutional protections? To this point, many may not have taken the local commissions modeled in mission, much like the state-level organization, seriously. But although members are often volunteers and rarely have professional training, cities and counties like Fort Worth, Texas, vest commissioners with enforcement power to, quote, conduct investigations and issue a charge or determination if conciliation is not reached. In New York City, the unit has the authority to levy fines and file criminal proceedings against those who discriminate. Even without a specific complaint, the commission also has the power to root out discrimination by process of investigation. But this focus on conciliation may cause many to dismiss the panels and their mission as innocuous. I did not even know that a county in which I resided and worked had such a commission. In fact, in this case entitled a Human Relations Commission, until I was subject of an inquiry. At the time that I found myself under investigation, I was teaching a clinical law course at Chapman School of Law in Orange County, California. Students began demonstrating, and they complained that I had engaged in hate speech during an event in my hometown. At this event, I had participated with a prominent congressman and others, expressing concern about documented extreme Islamist activity in the area. The students and a few undergraduate professors were demanding that the administration terminate my position. The university's chancellor reviewed the record and issued a vindication of my remarks as not hateful and called for an academic environment that respected free speech and robust debate. But during this time, I received a tip that the County Human Relations Commission was going to issue a public condemnation of my activity. While never receiving any formal notice of the meeting, I arrived to query the panel as to how this decision was reached. The points of condemnation were already drafted, and 11 of the 12 commissioners admitted that they had never reviewed the easily obtainable videotape of the event. They were all prepared to reach a final decision based upon the complaints that they had received. Since this time, I have watched these panels proliferate at the local and state level. The potential for legal training, oversight, professionalism, and scrutiny vary by location. On our call today, we have two presenters who have actually defended clients charged by similar commissions who have the same kind of focus. These experts will be suggesting opportunities for potential reform as well as presenting professional observations. Their biographical information is at the Federalist Society webpage that details this call. So first, I would like to thank both of them for joining this discussion today. And I will first ask Jeremy Tedesco of Alliance Defending Freedom to comment. Over to you, Jeremy.
Well, thank you, Karen. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity. I think we need to start the discussion with the natural starting point, which is Masterpiece Cake Shop, and the decision from the Supreme Court in that case. You know, that case, Colorado lost it because the court said that it failed to, the commission there, the Human Rights Commission, failed to approach the complaint against Jack Phillips with the new religious neutrality that the Constitution requires. And the court rightly reminded us that the Free Exercise Clause bars even subtle departures from neutrality, and its protection applies even upon the slight suspicion that state actions stem from animosity to religion. And I think a lot of what we are concerned about with these kind of commissions, the lack of impartiality, the due process problems, those concerns are really vindicated in the Masterpiece case by way of the free exercise claim and ultimately prevailing on the religious hostility issue. Of course, it's probably pretty well known, but the biggest problem for the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was that one of the commissioners had notoriously said that she found religious freedom to be a despicable piece of rhetoric when people like Jack Phillips raised it in these kinds of cases as a defense. And Justice Gorsuch at the argument mentioned other instances where the commissioners seemed to be dismissive. But I can tell you, you know how it's different when you're sitting in the room watching the presentation versus reading a transcript. I was in the room when the seven civil rights commissioners heard Jack Phillips' appeal of the decision against him, and I can tell you they were completely dismissive. They found it almost preposterous that anybody would come to them making the kind of arguments that Jack made under the Free Speech and Free Exercise Clause. And that just goes to show the problem that these folks that are on these commissions are usually political appointees that have absolutely no training or understanding of even the first principles of the First Amendment, let alone the complex issues that were raised in the case before the commission in Masterpiece. I think another really interesting thing about Masterpiece is the selective enforcement aspect of the decision. You know, a lot of people will say, well, Colorado can really just clean this up by not being so openly hostile with their comments. But that's simply not true. That buys into the narrowness idea that the other side says about the decision. But the court also said that the selective enforcement of the law showed religious hostility. And I think this is where the Human Rights Commissions, which I agree with Karen, are largely geared toward finding discrimination. It's almost like the fix is in as soon as you get a complaint filed against you, especially in these kinds of hot-button cases. Because the selective enforcement is going to be a problem, especially when sexual orientation, same-sex marriage, all those issues are before these commissions, because these progressive-minded commissioners are not going to punish people who support same-sex marriage if they decline to criticize same-sex marriage through the things they create, versus they have no problem punishing folks like Jack Phillips and others if they oppose same-sex marriage and are forced to create things that celebrate same-sex marriage. And so that selective enforcement thing is going to be double down for years, and I think be important protections against the kind of hostility we saw in Jack's case. But I also want to give you kind of a highlight reel of other things that we've dealt with these commissions. Now, Baronel Stutzman is another person that we're defending. That's in Washington State. Baronel is a florist who declined to create a floral arrangement celebrating the same-sex marriage of a longtime customer. In that case, the story of the Civil Rights Commission is one of inaction. What happened there was after the courts ruled against Baronel, a story hit the news that actually went national about a secular owner of Bedlam Coffee in Seattle profanely berating and expelling a group of Christians from his shop. His actions clearly violated the Washington law against discrimination, yet the Human Rights Commission nor the state AG did anything, took any even kind of threatened enforcement action against Bedlam's owner. Now compare this to what happened with Baronel. The state attorney general learned of the events underlying her case in a similar way through news reports. But what he did was call one of the gentlemen in the same-sex relationship three times and informed him that the state was devising a means to sue Baronel. And then he followed that through, taking the unprecedented steps of completely bypassing the Civil Rights Commission, suing Baronel in both her professional and personal capacities, and asking the state solicitor general to handle the case in the trial court. This different treatment between the situations in Baronel, the Bedlam Coffee Shop, and her, certainly shows the kind of bias that we're concerned about when it comes to these kinds of commissions. It looks even worse when you look at another case we handled, Sturmans versus Selecki, which involved whether pharmacists could continue to conscientiously object in context of refer, where they were asked to provide drugs that they objected to on moral grounds. The story in Storeman starts with Planned Parenthood and Narrow meeting with then-Washington governor's senior health policy advisor and pitching the idea that the Washington Board of Pharmacy, another one of these state agencies, should issue a new rule requiring pharmacists to dispense Plan B, an abortion-causing drug, despite any conscientious objection of the pharmacists. The Washington Board of Pharmacy, to its credit, initially resisted this and said they'd continue to respect the conscience rights of pharmacists. Well, the governor responded by appointing a former member of Planned Parenthood to the Board of Pharmacy and putting further pressure on the board. But when the board continued to resist, the governor's health advisor had urged Planned Parenthood to go to no other than the Washington Human Rights Commission and complain. Planned Parenthood did that, and the Washington Human Rights Commission responded by sending a letter to the Board of Pharmacy, reviewed in advance by Planned Parenthood, asserting that conscientious objections to Plan B were a form of unlawful discrimination. The letter went so far as to threaten the board members with personal liability under anti-discrimination law if they voted to protect conscientious objections to Plan B. So here you see how political the Washington Human Rights Commission can be. Where Bedlam Coffee is concerned, and you're in the context of what it would look like, you know, if Baronel is not prosecuted and Bedlam is, they just hands off, inaction. But in the situation with, you know, the Washington Board of Pharmacy and, a coordinated assault on the conscientious rights of pharmacists to refer, the Washington Human Rights Commission was all in, even threatening a fellow state board with charges of personal liability if all they did was follow their duty and vote on rules before the board. We have another case, Hands-On Originals. That case is a case where we represent Blaine Adamson. He's a print shop owner in Kentucky. He was approached and declined to print a shirt celebrating the Pride Festival in Lexington. And the Human Rights Commission in that case actually, I think, exhibited worse hostility than what the Supreme Court condemned a masterpiece. At a meeting where the commission adopted an administrative judge's earlier ruling against Blaine, the commission's vice chair, with no objection from his colleagues, stated that the commission needs to work to change views of those who hold Adamson's religious beliefs about marriage. He specifically complained that the Kentucky Baptists severed ties with a Louisville church that accepts same-sex marriages. And he said that this shows the commission needs to continue its work in this area and hope to see a change in attitude. The fact that the commission thinks it's its job to change its citizens and even the beliefs of religious institutions under its jurisdiction is very alarming. And that kind of open hostility to religion is problematic. A couple other ones I just want to raise real quickly. Michigan, the state of Michigan. In that state, LGBT advocates have been trying for years to get the state legislature to pass a law adding sexual orientation and gender identity to the state anti-discrimination law, but they had failed for years. And so instead they turned recently to the Civil Rights Commission of the state and asked them to just reinterpret sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity. And the Civil Rights Commission immediately obliged and issued an interpretive ruling saying that that's what it meant and that they would accept enforcement complaints under that theory. Several state legislatures asked the Attorney General for a legal opinion on that. The Attorney General issued an opinion saying that the commission had overstepped its bounds and that only the legislature or the people could amend the law and add those terms. A few days after that legal opinion came down from the Attorney General, the commission thumbed its nose at him and said they would continue to interpret the law consistent with its prior interpretation, and that only a court could really stop them from doing that. Again, you know, open hostility, open politicization of the board. Final one I want to mention is in Anchorage. In Anchorage, Alaska, the Equal Rights Commission there has a complaint before it alleging that a religious-based battered and homeless women's shelter engaged in gender identity discrimination. Full disclosure, we represent that homeless shelter at this point. But while the complaint was pending and before we got involved, the executive director of the commission swore against a complaint against the center's former attorney based on statements he made to media concerning his client's religious beliefs and the facts of the case. And this is an egregious abuse of power. you have to wonder how we as attorneys can effectively represent our clients before these kinds of tribunals. If what we say about them publicly can result in complaints being filed against us before the very commissions we're practicing in front of. So with that, Karen, I give it back to you.
Thank you, Jeremy, for a comprehensive survey or maybe sampling of what's developing around the country. And now we'll turn to Herb Gray, who's an attorney practicing in Oregon.
Thank you, Karen. I come to this with the benefit of having been the lead attorney for Sweet Cakes by Melissa, which dealt with a state board rather than a local board. But I agree with all the observations that Karen and Jeremy have made so far. It seems to me the fundamental problem here is a lack of accountability or standards. And even where there are some standards articulated, which is rare, they tend not to be followed. So I'd just like to make a preliminary observation that social justice without any standards is not justice, but actually is tyranny. So I'd like to make four observations about what's kind of wrong with these processes based on my experience. The first is that we need to restore the concept of separation of powers. I think most of the lawyers on the call will recognize the U.S. Constitution in Article 1, Section 1, places all legislative power in Congress, not with bureaucrats. And while rulemaking in certain contexts is authorized, we see violence in the application of that, as Jeremy described. Out here in Oregon, we had a similar situation where sexual orientation was administratively determined by the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to include gender identity. And along with that, I think judicial matters ought to be decided by judges and juries, not politicians or political appointees. Many of these statutes and ordinances that are applied by these commissions or boards have civil or criminal sanctions. The Sixth Amendment guarantees a right to jury trial in a criminal prosecution, and the Seventh Amendment says you should have a jury trial if more than $20 is involved. And what we see here is that a lot of times neither of those is observed, depending on whether they're criminal sanctions or civil. The second point I'd like to make, in addition to the separation of powers, is that limited and arbitrary process is not due process. So what occurs in Oregon with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and its elected commissioner is, regardless of whether there's a civil or a criminal sanction sought, the hearings are actually conducted by prosecutors, and that's their official title. So right from the beginning, even in a civil context, you kind of understand the mentality that you're dealing with. The second thing is that the administrative law judge, who is supposed to generate findings and recommendations, and the prosecutors bringing the case, and indeed all the investigators who work, are all working for the same agency. And in our particular situation, in the Sweet Cakes by Melissa case, the administrative law judge wasn't even a lawyer, and yet he was making legal rulings throughout the proceedings. And what we see generally in this type of situation is that the usual procedural safeguards of the judicial system that lawyers are familiar with are completely lacking, or they are arbitrarily and capriciously limited in some fashion. So, for example, it's common that discovery would be limited. You have to ask permission to take depositions or to seek certain documents. The rules of evidence are usually not applicable. So, for example, hearsay is often allowed by rule. And in our case, and I think with some of the cases that Jeremy mentioned, evidence was presented to the effect that the people against whom the claim had been brought had actually served the people bringing the complaint. And in our case, we were told that evidence of serving those people at different times was irrelevant, and we weren't allowed to even bring that in at the hearing. Another issue, getting to the hostility things that Jeremy spoke of, is we tried three times to disqualify the elected commissioner for making public statements indicating his bias, even before complaints were filed in the case. And those were rejected three times. And maybe in the Q&A I can discuss a little bit of that more about that. The final thing I'd like to talk about in terms of due process is that in most of these cases, they never come before a judge until getting to a state court of appeals or perhaps a federal court of appeals. And once you get to that point, they make decisions on whether the decision is supported by substantial evidence, and they employ various concepts of deference to the agency decisions. And the last point on this due process is, in our case, after the damages award was rendered by the commissioner, rather than that being bonded or somehow dealt with in a different way, my clients had to pay the judgment in full and place it in trust with the Bureau of Labor and Industries pending the outcome of an appeal. So it doesn't even make it feasible for them to hang on to their money while the case plays out. So in addition to the separation of powers and the due process arguments, there seems to be a real lack of standards about how decisions are made. So in the Sweetcakes case, what happened is the formal charges that were brought against my clients asked for a presumed amount of $150. And throughout the proceedings, what was clear is that it was presumed that they were entitled to $150 unless there was some evidence indicating that should be decreased. Those of us who function in the judicial system know that if you're seeking damages, that you start with $0 and you have to work your way up to what you can prove. So it's exactly the opposite of the way it functions in court. And in the same way, part of the component of the Sweetcakes decision as it played out was there was what was commonly referred to by mainstream media even as a gag order. My clients were told that they couldn't express any opinions about the validity of the action they'd taken or the beliefs that they had because there was a statute that says you can't express an intention to discriminate. And with considerable justification, even the mainstream media in Oregon and across the country was not very thrilled with that. The last point I'd like to make on this is that the laws, as they currently exist, make no provision for balancing the rights of protected classes. If in the cases that Jeremy was describing, and the same is true in Sweetcakes, there's often a conflict of religion and sexual orientation and gender identity, both of which, under almost any statute out there or administrative rule, are protected classes. And yet people with a religious viewpoint get no attention or deference whatsoever, something that I refer to as a one-way ratchet. There's only one way that it goes, and Jeremy alluded to that too. And oftentimes we find, even though these involve constitutional rights, they're subjected to rational basis review where the government just has to show it has a reason, as opposed to strict scrutiny where they have to show that there's a compelling reason or a compelling government interest for what they're doing. So with that background, I'd like to engage in a little bit of dreaming about possible solutions. And I'll just say at the outset, I don't have any illusions that after more than 100 years of the Administrative Procedures Act and similar types of things, we're not going to turn this around anytime soon. But let me suggest that there may be some legislative fixes and judicial fixes and maybe even a change in language that would be appropriate here. From a legislative standpoint, I would argue that there should not be an administrative process offered by a legislature if a judicial process is available so that we can maintain appropriate standards for evidence and due process and all those other things I described. I think there also has to be a way of establishing the standards for the people who are going to be making these decisions and authorizing their removal if they are biased. and that's often lacking. And the idea that they all work in the same agency oftentimes, I think, is very problematic. And I've already alluded to the need for standards for damages and fines and other relief that may be given by these entities. The last thing is, I think, that perhaps Congress and even legislatures could certainly restore a strict scrutiny standards so that the rights of different protected classes could be balanced as opposed to it being the one-way ratchet I described. From a judicial standpoint, I think that we need to limit the deference that courts show to these decisions. And I think the reason for that is was well articulated by the Supreme Court in the Masterpiece case. If the people making the decision are biased, there should not be deference accorded to that. And there needs to be meaningful evidentiary and due process standards rather than paying lip service to those concepts. I think they really need to be more robust than are currently recognized. And finally, we just need to be more respectful of the constitutional rights that are often implicated in these kinds of cases. So with that, I will turn it back to Karen.
Thank you, Herb. That was a litany of concerns that we all need to consider seriously. And I do have a question for both of you before we open up to Q&A. In listening to this, what is apparent is that there really is no curb against this unbridled discretion or unfettered discretion that the courts will note when it comes to local government decisions in many cases. And when you have these kinds of deficiencies in the process, and then you have a lack of right to appeal due to the fact that standing and the various issues, lack of a final administrative decision, oftentimes would bar some of these subjects of an investigation from reaching a court. And yet it doesn't seem that people in communities understand that what can happen is that these agencies become kind of the ultimate enforcers of a heckler's veto, that they respond at the behest of a group that complains, and they manage to chill or silence an entire point of view within a community. And so I'm wondering what you think of the idea of even starting at the political level. Most of these individuals, commissioners, are ostensibly at least responsive to some kind of political authority. And so if there was training, I mean, if from my conversations with a lot of individuals involved in these processes, they simply have no idea that there's supposed to be a balancing component to their exercise. Would the idea of training or some kind of a monitoring group that would report on where the deficiencies are, does this make sense?
I think those are great ideas. I think education is enormously important in this area, having a watchdog of the human rights groups, potentially. But I don't think we should neglect the litigation options. You know, that's primarily what I think about and deploy in my practice. And the reality is, you know, some people are more at risk of having these human rights commissions, especially in our day and age today, where, you know, Herb was talking about how religion is in these laws but doesn't seem to provide any protection. Yeah, it's that plus it's the left has really turned these non-discrimination laws into swords to punish religious believers on certain issues and topics, and like Karen was talking about, to chill and silence people. So, you know, from my practice area, what I spent a lot of time with is cases like Masterpiece, cases like Herb's case out in Oregon on behalf of Sweet Cakes. And so, you know, it's not, a lot of folks are really at risk. And Karen, to your point about there being a chill, I've talked to so many creatives who are Christians that were once in the wedding industry that have just completely abandoned it. And what that means is they've abandoned, for them, many times, what they feel is their genuine calling from God on how he wants to have them live their lives. He's given them, they believe, talents and skills and abilities that they're supposed to use to provide for their families and honor him. And they just abandon it because they don't know what to do and they're afraid, and they should be. And so there's litigation options. You can go and file pre-enforcement lawsuits against these commissions under the right scenarios. So I'll just raise one as an example. But in Minnesota, we filed a pre-enforcement action against the Minnesota Civil Rights Division, the division responsible for enforcing the Minnesota Public Accommodations Law, because that division had, their enforcement officials had said quite a few times that they were essentially targeting people whose religious convictions oppose same-sex marriage. They had also had a practice of using testers to set people up. So this commission would have their own employees call people, and they could do this sua sponte. They didn't even have to wait for a complaint to be filed against somebody. They could just read an article or find out information about a business that may be exercising their beliefs on this issue and just send out testers, have them call, set them up for an actual complaint filed by the division. So you can go to court and get, try to get a ruling from a declaratory ruling or even an injunction against that commission from enforcing the law in a way and manner that we're all concerned about it being enforced that would violate free speech or free exercise rights. And, I think that those kinds of rulings, if we can get them, would be very strong medicine for these commissions and make them think twice about the way in which they exercise their power.
Well, and if I could add to that a little bit, in the case of Sweet Cakes, the ultimate decision was made by the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, who happened to be a recovering civil rights lawyer. And so he knows exactly what the law is, and he applied it in the way that he thought it ought to be applied. And the first public statement that he made when the situation first cropped up was, our goal is to rehabilitate people, not to put them out of business, which presupposes that they need to be rehabilitated. So he knew exactly what he was doing and obviously passed the word to all of his subordinates to make sure they got the right answer. I think what's common with a lot of local boards is that there are political appointees, and I'm not sure many times that there's an adult in the room when those people get together. It's anyone's guess what kind of training or direction they get from anybody in observing, normal legal protocols.
It's interesting that there seems to be a lack of forethought when it comes to something like wielding a heckler's veto, that it is transitory, that the viewpoint that is advanced is transitory, and what is popular or approved by government today could be something that the current forces that are in ascendancy don't approve of or would be victims of in the future. It's something that can swing both ways, but it doesn't seem to be anything that they're thinking about as far as the way that this current trend is developed unchecked. So primarily, and that is why we're assembled today to ask a lot of questions and see what answers there might be. And at this point, I'd like to open the line for Q&A, Micah, but we're looking first for Mark David Hall, if he's on. He has written very thoughtfully on some of these issues, and if he is available, we had hoped to direct the first question to him.
All right, thank you, Karen. I see Mark Hall here is up first, so without further ado, let's go to our first question.
Hi, well, thanks very much, and Jeremy and Herb, a wonderful presentation, and as a non-attorney, I really appreciate you all being down in the trenches, and Herb, more than anyone else, has helped me understand that these administrative law proceedings are just ridiculous, Kafkaesque, and should be done away with, but my question has to do with those cases that actually started before real judges, or, of course, eventually they get to real judges, And these rural judges seem to just blow past the legal requirements in Washington State. The Baranoff-Stutzman case, for instance, went to a rural judge, and he just blew past the strict scrutiny requirement. And this makes me wonder, and I know we have to litigate these cases, but if we perhaps should start looking to legislative solutions, perhaps something along the lines of the Utah Compromise, where we have clear legislative accommodations crafted to protect small business owners and creative professionals, and perhaps as a trade-off, also adopt laws banning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So I'd just be real curious what you all think about that sort of compromise.
Sure. The Utah Compromise, as I understand it, wouldn't protect Baranoff-Stutzman. And most of the offerings I've seen that have been, attempts that were described as Utah Compromise-esque typically leave a whole swath of religious either institutions or believers open to the same kind of problems that we see happening with Jack Phillips and with Baranel. Religious institutions have just as much concern. So, what I've seen from religious, from Utah Compromise type propositions is largely, our side compromising almost everything and getting back only what, either what the bare minimum or what the Constitution already very clearly requires. The only other point I'd make about Utah Compromise, and this is not a point I make happily, but our experience is that when we engage in these kinds of compromises on these issues with the folks that are opposed to us on the other side, that's just one more step towards our ultimate submission. Because that's not going to satisfy the other side. I've never seen one of these compromise positions be satisfactory. Some of the legislative things going on around, I can't remember the name of the law. It was AB something in California, but it dealt with all of the religious colleges in California having an exemption from the sexual orientation and gender identity restrictions put on funding for California grants for students attending schools. And in what the legislative brouhaha was over that about a year ago was that they no longer wanted to provide that exemption to religious schools. And the position of our opponents was they can no longer have that. It's an affront to our community and to LGBT persons to continue to allow these schools to engage in what they see as unlawful activity. So, I mean, I just think that's a perfect example of where compromises were made, but then it just wasn't sufficient ultimately for the other side. And so I think it's concerning for us to go down that path, because I think that path ultimately leads to the erasing of all the exemptions that we may negotiate at one point or another in the process.
Thank you.
The only thing I would add to that is in Oregon, the only religious exemptions, which are very minimal, only apply to matters of employment, and they don't apply to public accommodation or to housing. So oftentimes there's a problem with even having a legislative recognition of the importance of religious beliefs and practices in some of these areas. And in my judgment, that's where the attention ought to start first, probably legislatively, because I agree with Jeremy. It tends to be very difficult to have a conversation and have any meaningful principled discussion about how this should be handled.
Well, and I would just, just a couple more comments to add very briefly. One is a lot of the new non-discrimination laws that we're seeing passed now either don't have religious exemptions, or they're adding sexual orientation and gender identity, one or the other or both, and they're not adding a religious exemption at all, or they're adding an incredibly narrow one. And I'd also raise that the Connecticut Civil Rights Commission, I don't know if that's exactly the name of the body there, but they have interpretive and enforcement authority for the non-discrimination laws in the state. They recently issued an opinion that said that the religious exemption under the law, which is pretty broadly written, very similar to, but I don't think completely tracking with Title VII's exemption, but nonetheless, they interpreted their relatively broad language to only apply to organizations that are engaged in religious worship, and that's it. And so, you know, I think that, you know, that's the trajectory that the other side is on, and I think it's important for us to recognize that.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Hi, I'm Dawn, and I'm from Michigan, and, you know, I was recently sitting in a Civil Rights Commission meeting, and the leader that was appointed is an openly homosexual person, and he's a director, and he, our attorney general here in Michigan, when he issues an appointment, I mean a decision, a document, that has the binding of the law. And he sent his attorney in to let them know that they went beyond the law. And they just sort of laughed and did nothing. And they were sort of mocking the attorney from the attorney general's office. And I'm just wondering, what remedy do we have when our attorney general issued a statement, his lawyer was there saying you're breaking the law, and they're just laughing at him, saying that it's an opinion, it means nothing. And in fact, their opinion's stronger than the lawyer and the attorney general of our state.
This is Jeremy. It's go to court and get a declaratory judgment that the Civil Rights Commission has indeed exceeded the scope of its statutory authority and is making law and is doing it in a way that's improper, that this is something that the legislature needs to handle, and not the Civil Rights Commission. It has no power to do that. So, I think even the Civil Rights Commission's public statement was essentially, you know, we're not going to stop and cease in enforcing the law in the way that we interpreted it, saying that sex means sexual orientation and gender identity, unless a court tells us not to. I mean, that's the essence of what they said. And so, you know, I think that has to be the next step, because I'm not sure, but perhaps the attorney general, his office has some kind of way to enforce it. I don't know. That's outside of my scope of understanding. But, you know, people who are at risk because of the state's interpretation of the law, I'm sorry, the Civil Rights Commission's interpretation of the law, could very well go to court and get a declaratory judgment.
Okay, thank you.
And Karen, we don't have any further questions lined up in the queue, so if you had any more questions for Jeremy and Herb, I'll let you know another question. Oh, wait, we do actually have a question just popped up. Without further ado, we'll go to the next question.
Hi, this is Chris Berger from Lawrence, Kansas. We have a commission that limits what you can present to them, even to a point sometimes of limiting you to 3 minutes in a presentation. Other than making just how can you create a record in front of a commission that limits you with regard to what you can speak and without having to go through, I'm not sure what the documentation would look like.
Is this someone that is trying to present who's actually had some sort of charges preferred against them?
Yes. Oh, it's always put in terms of an investigation.
Well, my sense, based on my experience at the Sweet Cakes case, is that you have to be mindful of which stage of the proceedings it's at, but you look first of all at what the statute requires, and secondly, what any applicable administrative rules may require in terms of the presentation. If it's left to the discretion of whoever is presiding, and it's an open-ended thing, and they're just arbitrarily deciding it's 3 minutes, then what we did repeatedly in Sweet Cakes was we kept filing motions trying to tee up things like that, like the bias of the commissioner, who was an elected public official. And even though there wasn't a statutory basis for us making that, we wanted to inject exactly the same sort of bias that was manifested in Masterpiece. So the idea that there can be some sort of judicial sanction imposed against someone and they're only allowed 3 minutes to defend themselves seems preposterous, and you just have to make a record and hope that somebody further up takes matters more seriously.
Thank you. That's encouraging.
And if I can just speak further to that, one of the things that I just chose to do in the Sweet Cakes case when I was dealing with the administrative law judge in the hearing, I never referred to him as judge or your honor, because he wasn't even a lawyer, let alone a judge. And I was tried to be respectful, but I always referred to him as Mr. So-and-so. And part of it was candidly just saying I had to have a stiff spine and say, you know, with all respect, that's not appropriate, or we need to be heard on certain things, and was much more assertive than I probably would have been in front of most judges. Because if it's not in the record, it never happened.
Let's go to our next question.
My name is Reed Smith. I work at First Liberty Institute. Full disclosure, we actually represent the attorney that you mentioned earlier in Alaska, who's representing the shelter. but one question I had, and this kind of goes to that issue, because obviously, as you mentioned, the attorney kind of stepped down while from his representation while he was under under investigation himself, is I think you'll have very good suggestions on improvements to the process, but as we've seen a number of times in the past, a lot of times it's intended that the process is the punishment. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to alleviate that aspect of it. I'll give up the floor. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any silver bullet. I think you have to avoid the process to the best of your ability. You know, like I talked about before, there's opportunities to file pre-enforcement actions. The whole idea behind pre-enforcement actions is that, you know, certain kind of threatened punishments chill speech. And yeah, there's standing problems and ripeness problems that you got to overcome, but those are overcomable. And I think, you know, that's a good avenue if you've got clients that are, you know that their number will come up sooner rather than later. The other thing is, I don't think it's, I think it's entirely reasonable to, if you've got the grounds to do it, turn around as soon as something happens to your client and sue in federal court. I mean, the most important thing is to extract your client from this process, this, you know, implicitly, oftentimes overtly biased process, because you're going to be in a much better position if you're in federal court and at least have the opportunity to develop a full record in under relatively fair procedure. And so, you know, it's definitely a roll of the dice to try to, you know, pull a case out of the state administrative tribunal and into federal court, and you'd have to do it early in the process. But you know, abstention is not a hard doctrine; it's a mushy doctrine, which with a lot of gray. And if you can position the case with the right atmospherics and the, you know, paint the right concerns about the nature of how unfair you know, the proceeding is that you're looking at in state court. I mean, there's a lot of different things you could do. I just think we need to be creative and proactive as much as we can, because as Herb talked about before, it's very, one of the things that concerns me the most when I get in front of one of these tribunals is I'm going to be hampered, severely hampered in my ability to create the kind of record, do depositions, and do all the things that I would normally do to create the kind of record I need on appeal to ultimately prevail in the case.
This is Herb. I agree with Jeremy, but I can also point to the Sweet Cakes case as a case study and how that may not work. The public firestorm in our situation started immediately, but the formal complaint wasn't lodged with the Bureau of Labor and Industries until 6 months later. And so it would have been, even though we thought about it, it would have been very difficult to bring a pre-enforcement action if there wasn't even a complaint pending. And by the time we were 8 to 10 months into the situation, our clients had been put out of business because of the relentless protests and other things that cut them off from their customers and their vendors and so on like that. So I agree with Jeremy that if you have the opportunity, that's absolutely the way to go. It's just that sometimes that's not within your control if there's nothing that's actually been filed quite yet.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Mike Padden here from Chicago. Let me apologize in advance. I came in during the latter part of Jeremy's presentation, so I hope if this isn't repetitive. But I thought in the Masterpiece cake case, it was very important to have that counterexample of the cake with the preferred message and where nothing was done. I'm wondering whether there is any organized attempt to get other examples of that sort in other contexts where these commissions will give a pass to certain similar conduct on the the other political side.
Yeah, well, first I'd want to point out that the situation in Masterpiece was organic and not organized. I certainly would welcome real-life complaints that are turned away by commissions and other places, so that we can have those same kind of facts. But I don't think they're necessary. And I say that because you can do that same work and get those same facts just through the deposition process. Now, again, who knows when you're in front of one of these biased tribunals whether the prosecutor will put on his impartial judicial hat and allow you to do depositions. But assuming you have an opportunity for depositions, you can really get some great admissions of the exact same thing. We did that in the Hands-On Originals case. We don't have any similar complaints that were filed that would present the opposite side, but we got the commissioners admitting a deposition that they would allow, they would not prosecute businesses that took, secular-based objections to requests that were very similar to what Blaine Adamson, the print shop, put on that case, declined, just on the opposite side. We had them making the same kind of admissions about, Masterpiece talked about how it was inappropriate for the commission to say, well, we're not going to force people to promote ideas through their work that the state we deem as offensive, and so that whole idea about the state having the authority to figure out what's offensive and what's not, and you will be forced to do things that the state says are not offensive, but if the state thinks they're offensive, you don't have to do them. That was a problem also in Masterpiece. You can get admissions like that too, a very very clear path for those kinds of admissions and deposition testimony. So I'm just saying, I think there's a lot of avenues to get them. And one of them certainly is the kind of facts we had in Masterpiece, where somebody actually got declined and the Civil Rights Commission exonerated the businesses, even though their situations were on all fours with Jack Phillips.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey. I'm the Libertarian candidate for Attorney General in New York. And all my experience in civil rights has been in the federal courts, and I'm wondering if anyone knows in New York if you have similar problems to this and what role the Attorney General might take in dealing with them.
Unfortunately, I don't have any knowledge base to answer that question about what specifically in New York. But I'm guessing that the state attorneys general in every state have investigatory and enforcement possibilities when it comes to these things and things they can do to maybe rein in civil rights commissions or other kinds of government bodies that are out of control.
Thank you, Jeremy. And Karen, there are no more questions lined up, so if you or our speakers had any closing remarks, please feel free.
I would like to ask a very quick question, and that is, we've demonstrated that these commissions reach an entire range of expressive rights, and yet we also touched in the discussion on the fact that attorneys have also at times had their own speech rights called into question. And I know that the ABA had proposed a model rule that would address attorney remarks when off, you know, off duty, but in a social or other than a legal setting. And I'm wondering if you, either of you, know what the acceptance of that model rule has been in any particular states. Is that also something that attorneys are becoming mindful of?
Well,
yeah, I can use that. Go ahead, Herb.
Well, I was going to say, this is Herb. I know that the only state where it's been formally adopted, the amended model rule 8.4G, has only been adopted in Vermont, which doesn't have a public process. It's been rejected, or it's in the process of receiving comments everywhere else. In my experience, serving on some nationwide committees and just talking to people more locally, I think it's something that's come to the attention of almost all lawyers, and there's a pretty healthy skepticism about the wisdom of a rule that's as extensive as the ABA model rule. So there seems to be a real resistance to it that comes from across the political spectrum, and only a few people that are really true believers continue to advocate it.
Yeah, I was going to say, similar to what Herb said as far as the status goes, it has only been adopted in Vermont. It's actually been rejected in multiple states. I don't know that it's a lot of states, but you know, it's certainly, you know, five or six states have said no to it at this point. That doesn't mean they can't come back and ask again in each of those states. And, you know, Karen, I had the same thought when the Anchorage situation occurred, was, wow, this is, you know, exactly what we've been concerned about and been talking about with other attorneys and groups we work with, that 8.4G, the proposed rule, you know, ultimately could put our licenses at risk simply for, you know, what we say in the context of our activities as attorneys and how we represent clients, even, you know, exceeding the scope of our work and just our non-work related expression. And Anchorage doing what it did, I think, is, you know, an indicator of how these kinds of regulations can be abused.
My own sense is that what Anchorage has done in the case of the lawyer up there, they've overplayed their hand, because people who are paying attention and have heard about that are appalled for all the reasons that Jeremy just said. And I think it lends credence to the concerns expressed in opposition to Model Rule 8.4G.
Thank you both. Mike, I think we're ready to turn it back over to you for concluding remarks.
All right. Thanks, Karen. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback at email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.